when things don't go as planned, I think everyone has a choice to make. You can get very negative and dejected, or you can pick the other path and turn those lessons into a positive. And so no one is perfect at this. It takes a lot of lessons to try to figure this out.
Hey, Chad. Welcome to the Get in the Mode podcast.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me.
For the benefit of our listeners and audience, can you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about your company.
We'd love to. I'm Chad Durge. I'm the Chief Revenue Officer and President of a SaaS fintech company called Era. We started about 4.5 years ago. We were born out of the world of Wall Street investment research. And we've created a product that allows financial research people, whether they're in asset management, sell-side research, corporate finance, to more effectively manage the massive amount of qualitative data that comes at them on a daily basis and into which they must be finely tuned to do their job properly. So the management and monitoring of Wall Street events is a big part of what we do differently. And just to give you a little context for anyone who doesn't follow the space closely, there's almost an overwhelming amount of events where company management teams present to stakeholders. Every publicly traded U.S. company is required by the SEC to report earnings 4 times a year. And most of those companies have conference calls. Those companies also present at lots of other conferences, many of them hosted by global banks. And so we dial in and transcribe those events in real time. And we do a lot of things using natural language processing to pull out information that's really relevant to our customers.
Awesome. Tell us a little bit about your role at this company.
I was part of the founding team. There was 4 of us. The founders are Ken Senna and Brian Healy. Connor McDade and I came on and were sort of the team that launched the company. I've always taken the role of really heading up most of the things on the business side. So on the customer side and marketing side. And as we've grown, that involves customer success as well. That's really my focus.
I know when we talked, you succeeded at product market fit. Walk us through that journey of what it was like being a SaaS company. I feel like that's probably the number one challenge SaaS companies face before they get the traction. So maybe if you could walk us through that journey, that'd be great.
Yeah. And it didn't happen without a pivot. When we first started, what we were doing was using machine learning to understand the velocity of information that was happening around each given company. Through that, trying to find a predictive value. So what was the likelihood of a stock moving up or down based on some of those metrics? And the numbers were actually very good. We had a lot of interest from the customer base, if you will, but it didn't really fit with the fundamental active investors out there. And I think the reason for that is that machine learning doesn't do a very good job of explaining itself. So the why is very important. If there is a prediction for movement in an equity, it needs to be boiled down into a human digestible why, and it needs to fit into a thesis. Maybe 9 months after we started, we actually began to do much more around speech to text and essentially becoming a productivity suite where we could help our investors to just find that information and acquire knowledge around events, news, filings, all of that content in an easier way. And so that is where we found the product fit. That is where we're most engaged with our customers today. There's always challenges. I think that one of the things that we've learned, even as we've grown over the last many years, is selling a product, even a product that has great efficiency over the existing process, is difficult when the existing process is not broken. And what you're battling there is change and inertia. For us, in the early days especially, and even today, many times we're not finding that there's a mandated buyer within the group that manages the tech stack for a large asset manager or a global bank.
our job as many times is to convince the end user of this product that we're bringing. We do a very good job. We're very successful. Once we get a group of supporters and champions within a customer, we're very, very successful at expanding within that business. That's the challenge that I think that we still battle. And there's some ways that we try to make that a little easier for us.
I'm curious, like a lot of AI-based companies coming up with the advancements in AI. I should say machine learning, AI is more umbrella term. But obviously that gets thrown around in a lot of SaaS products. From that perspective of trust in machine learning, I think that's like in your case, particularly, it's, are these signals that the machine learning algorithms and models are prompting in terms of prediction, how accurate is that, the trust in the accuracy of the sentiment analysis that you're performing? How do you think, maybe first, if you can talk about your company's way of addressing that trust hurdle, and perhaps maybe if you can extrapolate that to perhaps other companies, what are the other ways that companies can address that potential hurdle or challenge?
Obviously, there's some incredible use cases for machine learning. Even in the world of asset management, where we focus, the quantitative side of asset management has done a great job over the last decade of finding ways to effectively use ML. On the fundamental side, it's slower going, I would say. The idea of automated research analyst, which was the original acronym for our company, AI, Equity Research Analyst. It just isn't there because of the things that I mentioned before, but it's not there to make predictions, I would say. But it's getting very close in other ways to improve efficiency. For instance, we've been working, Brad Healy, who's our co-founder and CTO, has been building a summary model where we can take an event that lasts for an hour and a transcript, which is 12 to 15 pages, and now boil it down into bullet points, and even bullet points that are positive or negative. Those are ways that I think we can help the fundamental set, and they can trust that in a different way than they can trust a prediction. In a way, trying to predict something for a fundamental user is going a step too far and actually trying to do their job. That's what they're there to do. But there's lots of other efficiency tools that we're seeing. OpenAI is doing amazing things, even in our world of speech to text. It's been pretty amazing what's happened in that ASR world in just the last couple of years. The error rates are going down at a very fast pace. You can even see how people use their speech to text on a phone. I never would have tried that 4 or 5 years ago. And now my wife does nothing but speak to her phone. It is changing pretty rapidly.
One thing that's coming out from what you're saying is you talked a little bit about the bullet list of positive or negative things and then sharing that. I think it's the level of transparency that you could show your end users or customers on why the data is presented this way. I know Facebook and all the social media companies use AI and TikTok especially to present what sort of content we get. Like, I would be interested to know why I am presented what's on my feed. Maybe that'll allow me to, it's almost like social media companies know more about you than yourselves.
It's a really good point because we saw that in our situation where, again, there was great interest in our ability to have very good numbers around the predictive quality of whether we thought a stock was going to go up or down. But as we tried to boil that into explainability with transparency, the list was too long. The actual reasons that the model picked for the direction of the likely direction of an equity could be thousands of variables. And so that's too much for a human. I think that if products did a better job of explaining themselves and to the end user, where the end user could then agree or disagree with some of those underpinnings, you're right. I think that the trust would get much better.
I think that's good learning from your experience with ML. So thank you for that. I want to change gears. You've got a four-founder company and you're VC-backed. Number one, how did you guys get together? And then perhaps talk about four executive founders in leadership roles. How do you guys manage boundaries? How do you guys figure out who's accountable for what? Talk to us about that experience.
There's a lot to do, and no one's stepping on anyone's toes. I'll try to be brief. The original story, so Ken Sennett and Brian Healy, who are the founders of Era, they met. So Ken, myself, and Connor McDade, who's our CFO and COO, all work together at Evercore. Brian Healy is a very senior and experienced engineer, one of the original team leaders for Amazon Alexa before joining us. And so Ken Sennett was a research analyst at Evercore, and his space was the internet space. And so Brian became someone that Ken met and was kind enough to lend his time to speak with Ken's customers, portfolio managers, analysts, people like that. Those meetings were still popular. Brian had so much information about the way these big tech companies were using machine learning and AI that we had dozens of meetings over the course of 2016, 17. And in most of those meetings, portfolio managers and analysts were saying, your background would be amazing if you could build something that could help us with all of this data, all this content that we have to deal with the old-fashioned way. After that came up a couple dozen times, Ken and Brian actually said, all right, well, why don't we do this? And so that was the genesis of the firm as we actually launched, and Connor and I joined. Connor is a very skilled analyst and took on the role of CFO with ease. And he's actually expanded that, where he handles a lot of our data relationships and more typical COO type responsibilities. Ken, who's our CEO, runs all business in the company, spends a lot of time, as you must, at a startup with funding and investors and the board and everything in that world. And Brian runs a really skilled and talented engineering team. He's always had the philosophy where you hire other senior people who are good leaders and they don't need a lot of oversight. And so I think he's done a really good job with that. He runs that piece. And again, I spend most of my day on the commercial business side. So that really is how our four roles break down.
One thing I wanted to touch upon, since we've talked about SaaS companies in general, the alignment of SaaS companies' success with the end customers or end users' success. Obviously, I almost feel like sometimes they could be counterintuitive and maybe there might be some conflicts there. But like, I know SaaS companies that are especially VC-backed, customer at CAC, customer acquisition cost, churn, all of those metrics are very important. And I'm curious to hear, I'm sure this is a challenge for SaaS companies in general. How much of that success can be aligned with the end user success? A lot of SaaS products don't directly, maybe at the time of demo, maybe at the time of initial setting up of accounts, they work with customers. There's not like a customization phase for a SaaS product. Talk about your thoughts on this, and that your personal thoughts may not be related to your product. I'm curious to hear how you would approach
it. I mean, clearly, there is a relationship between the success of a company and the problem that they're solving, right? And how successfully they're solving that problem. But is it a perfect and direct relationship? Probably not, because there's other things that play into it, particularly around the funding. What is the funding environment at any given time? For us, I would say that we are very lucky to enjoy extremely low churn. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the areas of great success for us is the ability to expand within existing accounts once we have them. So I would argue that our end user experience is very good. We get very high engagement from our existing customer base. We'd like to grow faster, selling B2B software into our customer set is not the easiest thing in the world. We are selling a product into a group of people who I'd argue are some of the busiest people you'll find in any line of work. They get thousands of emails, Bloomberg messages, phone calls every day. So the ability to even get in touch with them is difficult. But once you're in touch, pinpointing the value that you're providing is crucial, and doing it in a succinct way is very important. We are a small company with limited resources. And so we've always had a pretty small go-to-market group. And I think that in our cases, there are perfect relationship between how our end users view our product and our growth. There's a positive relationship, but I don't think it's a perfect relationship.
In a way, like I think about the Salesforce example. Salesforce is probably the biggest CRM out there, but a lot of SaaS companies start with a certain, once they find product market, it's okay, now they found the target market. And then they realize, I'm not talking about your product, but in general, like they want to move up the value chain to the enterprise market. Now, they might have started with the small business market. Now they're wanting to move up the value chain for better margins and things like that. Perhaps the total addressable market also is bigger. In a way, the original customers, the initial set of segment of customers that you acquired become, okay, we've been there, done that. Let's now move up, find the bigger, better deals. And I'm sure the folks at Salesforce are probably thinking about it too. Like, as much as Salesforce is the number one, where is it the number one and how do they get there? And as they get bigger, obviously, there is that challenge of just can't please everybody and then you evolve. So anyway, I don't know if there's a solution, but I think there's just alleviating here.
There's always a risk as you move into sort of adjacent problem sets. There's a risk of wasting dev cycles and not finding that same fit. I think the best companies are the ones who are able to do that.
I know you shared a little bit about some of your personal events in your life, a recent tragedy. If you want to share a little bit about that, I'm curious to maybe the audience can walk through that experience a little bit and learn a thing or two. Obviously, it's been a journey for you guys, but maybe we'll start with you sharing what that event has been recently. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about that.
Just about a month ago, we lost our daughter, our 16-year-old daughter, Penny Durgy. She had a rare condition called neurofibromatosis, or NF1, which affects people in lots of different ways. Some people actually don't even know that they have NF1 for much of their life. Other people have much more serious symptoms as a result of it. Penny battled a few things. When she was a little girl, she had something called pseudarthrosis in her right leg, which is essentially where the long bone of her tibia was bowed and thought there should be a joint in the middle of the tibia. So we were lucky. We had these incredible doctors at Hospital for Special Surgery in New York who were able to help her with that. After lots of different procedures, she was in all sorts of body casts and she wore a brace for most of her life, but it really didn't slow her down. And that's really one of the very important lessons. I think when she was little, my wife, Kate, and I decided that we were not going to let medical issues define Penny, but she actually took that on herself as she grew up. And as a result, taught us some incredible lessons about life, faith, and that it's possible to live a full and joyful life, even in the midst of incredible challenges. It really is a shift of mindset that one must adopt. So Patty shows positivity, humor, and persistence in battling her medical issues, never complained, ever. She ultimately developed a type of malignant cancer of the brain called glioblastoma, which doesn't actually happen often with NF1. In her case, it did. And so over the last 2 years, she battled that until she passed in early November. But even many of her friends didn't know the severity of what she faced. And so after she passed, people became more aware of the details, and the response has been pretty astonishing. There's a general attitude from the community of friends and family around us that maybe we should stop complaining about the small stuff and appreciate the beauty in everyday things, the beauty in imperfection. And I think Penny showed us that she was comfortable with the idea that a higher power was in charge of the ultimate outcome. And even if that meant a short life, she was here for a purpose and she lived life to the fullest.
I'm curious to hear, maybe at least in my experience, as we all grow, as we age and become more seasoned, I think. It's a humility, like when you're younger, invincible, for lack of a better word. And then it's amazing how she, from what you're describing, actually got that in that short span of time that she spent, number one. And I think that you talked a little bit about like, stop complaining and take courage and joy in the smaller things of life. I think there's got to be some level of humility to be able to do that. Like, I don't have anything that is terminal like that, but hopefully, at least at the moment. And it took me a while to develop that level of humility, and I'm still not there, but at least it's a journey. I wonder how that is for more. Maybe you can share a little bit about, is it humility or is there something that is underlying, that is ceding that control to something bigger? We can only guess, but I'm curious, since you've personally experienced that with your daughter.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I would describe it as humility or peace and comfort with inevitable outcomes. I think that there's a lesson here, even in business. Anyone in business wants to do everything they can to positively affect their outcome. And we wanted the same, and yet we did. We saw the best doctors in the world who helped her greatly with her leg issue and even with glioblastoma, which really is a terminal aggressive cancer. The doctors at MSK did a great job. Ultimately, we don't control everything. And I think that is true in business also. So understanding that and being okay with it, it's not a bad, right? When things don't go as planned, I think everyone has a choice to make. You can get very negative and dejected, or you can pick the other path and turn those lessons into a positive. And no one is perfect at this. It takes a lot of lessons to try to figure this out. As we look back at Penny's life, I think that's one of the things that really resonates with us is how well she did this for, and it's not something really that's learned. So my wife and my two sons and I started a charity foundation in Penny's name. We actually launched this week, Penny's Flight. And the mission is to make much needed advances in NF research and awareness. But there's also a dual mission and message, I would say, to help inspire others to find beauty in imperfection, positivity in the face of challenge, faith over fear, if you will.
I like that, faith over fear. I think fear is a key component to our instinct or reaction to control when something's not going our way.
Exactly. I agree.
I know you talked about the foundation. Your wife is going on an upcoming show.
I won't give the details away, but my wife's background is PR, and she's for 20 years worked in the fashion world and did PR, and then she's moved more to the corporate world on the consumer side, doing lots of PR. And so she's done a good job in a short amount of time getting this message out there. And I think it does resonate with people. And so you can find out more about, I hate to plug this, but pennysflight.org. You can find out more about this, but there's many events and there are going to be some articles that are coming out soon. And then I think Kate is going to be on an upcoming show. And that's really the message. And we are spending a lot of time, as I mentioned, the money raised, the primary use of dollars is for neurofibromatosis research. It's a disease that affects many people. It's actually the largest genetic disease in the world, but one out of just about 2,500 births worldwide have someone who's born with NF. And there's no cure. There have been great steps to understand the condition better over the last decade, I would say. And there's an improving amount of dollars that are going to this, especially from the Department of Defense and some larger organizations like Children's Tumor Foundation does a great job with helping families and funding a lot of these projects. And then there's some other sort of more cutting edge organizations like the Gilbert Family Foundation. Dan Gilbert, who founded Quicken Loans, has done a lot of great work to raise money for things like gene therapy. And so that's a little more cutting edge, but I think we will find a cure and we're getting closer every day.
What is your learning as a father from this experience? Perhaps it may not be learning, but I'm curious, a truth that you found or something of significance.
As you can imagine, we have spent a lot of time over the last month looking at pictures and videos. You can never take enough videos, by the way. It's always true. And now it's easier than ever. Get the iPhone out and video everything. But it's amazing how fast things go. This is a cliche and everyone says it all the time, but every stage of life, especially as we have kids, goes so quickly. And so soaking up those thoughts and being present in those moments is something that we learned. And once we learned that Penny had glioblastoma just about 2 years ago, we really didn't talk much about the inevitable way that this ends for nearly everyone that has that disease. But we did, I think, spend more time being more mindful of each day that we had with each other and with Penny, and really spending that time with her and sort of soaking up her love and showing her ours. It's something that is said all the time, but I would just reiterate, live in the moment as much as you can, especially when you're with family and friends. It is the most important thing.
Any, I don't know if resource is the right word, but anything that you found, friends, family members, and I'm more interested in just you as a father, like just from your experience that I found this very helpful. And what would that be for a father's role in all of this?
Hopefully very few or none of your listeners ever have to go through something like losing a child, but it can be applied in other ways. I would say that one of the things that was helpful for us, maybe back to your sharing and transparency theme that we were talking about earlier, as Penny was declining, I think that's a private moment for many people. We actually chose to bring her friends and our friends and family into that environment. And so our house over the 10 days or so before Penny passed was absolutely filled with love and laughter, plenty of sadness, but it was also a celebration of who she was and her life and the support that we felt by bringing others into that environment was otherworldly. It really was. And so everyone goes through tough times. People are there to help and share. And the immediate reaction for most people, me included, is to isolate. And anything you can do to resist that when you're having a challenge is really helpful.
Thanks for sharing that. Any books or anything that you've read recently, I'm talking more in general, that you've in the last few years or anything that you've found useful, and this could be anything like business or leadership or really anything, self-improvement, that you found perhaps useful?
Yes. You're putting me on the spot, so I don't have a lot of the titles at my fingertips.
Tell us a little bit about what the book is about. Maybe we'll put the title later in the show notes.
Actually, I have it right here. One is more of a general read, is a book called How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan that talks about consciousness. I won't get into all the details, but that's a great one that is worth looking up. And then I think more in the business realm and even more in the sales realm, Aaron Ross, who was a former FBI negotiator, has written a few books. Predictable Revenue is one of those, and it's excellent. It's excellent for helping sales leaders. I think it's excellent for understanding negotiations of any type.
Again, I'm putting you on the spot a little bit here. This could be interesting. If we were to send you to an island, the three songs that you can take on your iPhone, and that's all you get, and you have to hear it on repeat, and you're cast away. What would those be?
Oh boy,
big music fan. I'm going to say that there's a song called Reba, big fan of. I'd have to pick something from the Beatles, Get Back maybe, or a Walrus. And I'm going to say something from a new band called Goose that's on the scene that is absolutely phenomenal on it. So those are my three.
That's funny you pick Get Back from the Beatles. I was thinking you'd pick something a little more deeper, but it's funny. Like, I can't imagine Chad listening to Get Back on repeat in an island that he's cast away. But on that sort of funny note, we'll end this podcast. And thank you for being a great guest on the Get in the Mode podcast, Chad. Thanks for being on.
Thank you so much, David. Appreciate it.